Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This week we conclude our three-part Chautauqua series, bringing to you the voices of some of American history's leading figures with a delightful visit with writer Louisa May Alcott, played by Anne Howard. But before we do that, let's take a look at an event that occurred this week in history. In 1886, Atlanta pharmacist John S. Pemberton invented the flavor syrup for what is today one of the most popular soft drinks around the world, Coca-Cola. At his chemical company in Atlanta on May 8, 1886, Pemberton created the flavorful sweetened syrup that, when combined with carbonated water, would eventually become a symbol of American taste and a mainstay in American culture. Pemberton's bookkeeper, Frank Robinson, chose the name for the drink and penned it in the flowing cursive script that has become the all-too-familiar Coca-Cola trademark. Originally, Pemberton advertised his drink as a tonic for the most common ailments, and his formula included caffeine-rich extracts of the cola nut and cocaine from the coca leaf. Cocaine was removed from the drink's formula in 1905. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, under a bill introduced by Congressman Dana Rohrabacher of California, American World War II vets would be able to seek reparations for mistreatment as POWs in Japanese prison camps during the war. The proposal would allow the estimated 40,000 Americans who underwent hard manual labor as prisoners in Japan to sue in state or federal court the Japanese companies they were forced to work for during the war. Both living POWs and their descendants could seek reparations under the proposed bill. To all those thinking about stealing and selling priceless historical documents, beware. The U.S. District Court in New York has indicted two men, John William Rooney and Marshall Lawrence Pierce III, for conspiring to steal and sell the 1814 Treaty of Fontainebleau. Stolen in 1988 from the French Naval Archives in Paris, this valuable historical document bears Napoleon's signature. The treaty forced Napoleon to renounce his claim as Emperor of the French Empire and bound him to exile on the island of Elba. This is Talking History. This is the third program in our three-part Chautauqua series in which we've brought to you the voices of some of the leading figures in American history. This week we welcome writer Louisa May Alcott. The date is July 23, 1879, and Alcott is in Concord, Massachusetts for the opening of the Concord School of Philosophy. And today she registered to vote. Welcome, Ms. Alcott.
Oh, welcome. I'm so proud of having this opportunity today to register to vote, not for everything, just for the school committee, but I'm the first woman in Concord to do it.
Why did you decide to do this?
Oh, well, because women deserve to be equal partners with men. You know, I've always preached that, that a woman has her duties in the world as well as in the home. And I have gone out to vote, even though I can't say many women in Concord are very interesting.
So obviously you think women should have the franchise. Do you think it'll ever happen nationally?
Well, I certainly hope so. I write articles for the Women's Journal, and I'm friends with a lot of the people who are leading this battle to get women recognized as equals to men.
You must be getting some resistance on this.
Well, there, you know, even in Concord, you know, Concord thinks so much of itself. It thinks it's such an intellectual center. I had a private laugh when Mrs. Sanborn asked one of the newcomers to the conference with her superior air, had she ever looked into Plato? And the modest lady from Jackson answered with a twinkle at me, we have been reading Plato in Greek for the past 6 years. Oh, I hate sham and I love a joke. But that's Concord. It has a gray color, that's for sure.
That's great. Well, speaking of Plato, tell us about this new Concord School of Philosophy.
Well, this, of course, is my father's dream, and he's finally achieved his dream. You know, my father, Bronson Alcott, is a philosopher. Now, a philosopher is not a very practical person to have in your family in lots of ways, but he has dreamed of having a place where people could come together and talk. Now, you know, I feel a little bit excited about it. There are a good many things going on. But the town swarms with budding philosophers, and they roost on our step like hens waiting for corn. father revels in it, and we keep the hotel going and try to look as if we liked it. Of course, what we have to do is feed and entertain them. My sister and sister Anna and I do this all the time. If they were philanthropists, I should enjoy it, but speculation seems a waste of time when there is so much real work crying to be done. Why discuss the unknowable until our poor are fed and the wicked saved?
Well, this school's mostly going to be for men, so I guess I might ask you, where did your education come from? Did your father help in your education, maybe at the Temple School in Boston?
Oh, my father was behind all of my education, and he began me thinking about my moral education when I was a very young child. You know, he used to set up temptations for us. He once put an apple out, which we were not supposed to take unless allowed to and given permission. And my sister Anna, who was very moral, walked right past it. But I couldn't do it. I walked once, I walked twice, and then I came back and I took it. And, of course, my father knew I was going to have it. And I had said, me, gonna have it. And I guess I showed early that I needed his moral education because I was a stubborn child. But he taught me to keep a journal, which I did from the time I was quite young. You know, there's one right here, and I could tell you about the fact that when I was 10, I wrote about a wonderful run in the woods, and the seeing the sunlight upon the green of the meadow, that I felt close to God. And then I went back and I wrote in my journal, and I said, I had a pleasant time with my mind, and I was happy. Hmm. See what kind of child I was. Obedient? Maybe. But certainly I was interested in writing from the very beginning.
Well, how did you make the transition from journal writing to writing, for example, your most famous book, Little Women?
Well, you know, we girls made our own entertainment. There were four of us, and there were other people in our community, and we never had any money. But we had all dreams of plays, and we put on plays. We put on plays as long as I can remember. I always got to be the hero because I wrote most of the plays. But my sisters and I and other children in the neighborhood put on plays in the barn, and someone had to write the script, and usually it was I. And that's how I began creating my stories. My father always encouraged me, too, to write my thoughts. And although I seldom went to what you would call a regular school, we read regularly, and we studied regularly, and certainly we practiced the dramatic arts to a great degree.
So Little Woman really is autobiographical, then, to an extent.
Well, you know, I had written a number of fairly successful stories. I'd written up Hospital Sketches, which was an account of my days as a nurse, and I'd written a number of little stories. I'd even been published in The Atlantic, that stiff old Atlantic. Everyone thinks that's pretty important. And Mr. Niles asked me if I'd write a book for girls. Now, I really didn't much want to do that. Never knew many girls, never liked them. You know, I always had a boy's spirit under my bib and tucker. But I said I'd try. I thought perhaps some of our family games and such would make a good story. And, well, it was a success, that's for sure.
Well, Little Woman and even some of your later works have been described as domestic narratives, but previous to that, some of your stories have been described as potboilers, as being lurid and violent. Do you agree with that?
Oh, now. Are you going to talk about those stories? You know, I gave those to Joe to write in Little Women, and something had to put a rug on the floor and food in the stomachs, and I was the one elected to do that. You know, I have pursued just about every career a respectable woman could in the time that I was trying to help my family. And I discovered that I could write the blood and thunder stories faster than anything else. And they sold pretty well.
Well, I guess they did. Is that why you used a pseudonym for those works?
Well, after all, let's remember, I was living in Concord, and Concord is dear, gray Concord, presided over by Mr. Ralph Waldo Emerson, a dear friend of our family, but a man who thinks of no one walking very far off a narrow line of propriety.
Well, okay. Let me switch gears a bit here, because I think one of your more interesting books is Work, A Story of Experience, which just came out 6 years ago. Where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, I was trying to find another story to write beyond the young people's books. You know, one gets a little tired of writing, if you'll excuse it, moral pap for the young. but that seems to be what has paved my way. And I wanted to tell others, women especially, how they could get on in the world if they were required to. And work covers my own kind of experience. They're all the careers that I pursued, some of them more successfully than others. I did want to be an actress, for example, but my family would never have approved of that, although one of my plays was produced, and I certainly acted in all the amateur productions. But I wanted to show how a woman could make her way without being dependent, without having to marry. And that's an important thing to understand.
Again, that's kind of a controversial point today in 1879, the idea that women should be independent and work outside the home. What has been the response to you on that note?
Well, the women who understand it, those women who are independent, who have not had to rely upon a brother, an uncle, or a male relative simply because they have not married, well, those people understand it. In fact, I wrote about them just before I wrote Little Women. Rather famous little piece called Happy Women, in which I wrote about all the good independent spinsters I knew who had taken it upon themselves to take care of themselves. You know, when I got ready to write that, I wrote into my journal a line that I think is very important. Liberty is a better husband than love for some of us.
That
and
must
I think
have gotten
that's
you
important
into some
to remember.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you tell us a little bit. You rather daringly became a nurse during the Civil War. How did that go?
Well, I was sent to Washington. I was very thrilled at being there. I'd never been to our nation's capital before. It was the first time I'd been very far out of Massachusetts, and I'd found terrible conditions. No air, for example, in the wards, and the food, well, you cannot imagine what the food was like. But I lasted only 6 weeks there. I succumbed to typhoid. Now, I was a vegetable product, a very healthy woman, accustomed to walking every day and to eating a very fine diet. And in those closed quarters and with the disease going round, I soon was ill myself, and my father had to come to rescue me.
You were also a teacher. How did that go?
Oh, I was not a good teacher. It takes more patience than I have to lead young minds. I had been a tutor, I had been a companion, I had been a governess, I had even gone out to service once. That was a very strange experience.
How did your mother and father both respond to this seeming need of yours to go out and be independent? I imagine your father is supportive, but what about your mother?
Well, someone had to feed the family. Now, my mother was a woman who did her share to help the family from the beginning. She ran what was called an intelligence office. That is, something like an employment service to which people could go to find jobs. And she was always occupied, as we all were, for my father had many talents, but making money was not one of them. And I learned from the time I was 14 that I was going to have to be the person on whom the family depended. And they could depend on me.
So why haven't you married?
I'd rather be an independent spinster and paddle my own canoe. That's what I wrote in my journal fairly recently. I really believe that taking care of my family is my first responsibility. Besides, all the men that I meet are peculiar. That's all it has ever been. And I must admit, I'm more interested in most of the women I've met than any of the men.
No man ever took your fancy enough to want to marry him?
No, I'm afraid that's true. And I've always had my first responsibility to take care of my family. And since I'm the breadwinner for already my father, my mother, and my three sisters, it does keep me fairly well occupied. Now, of course, Lizzie died, but by that time, Anna had married and had two children of her own, and her husband had died. So you see, I have had a very busy occupation simply keeping body and all of our souls together.
Well, you certainly have. Let me ask you then, do you think you might be settling down in Concord for a while or perhaps for the rest of your life?
Oh, I always will come back to Concord because that is where my family lives. But I've found that I often write better if I'm removed from the distractions of my family. I go take rooms in Boston quite frequently. I have a little cottage at Nanquit, which I enjoy a great deal and to which I escape from time to time.
Well, it sounds like a very nice life, but doesn't the idea of being around people like Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne and the other great writers and thinkers, or even your father for that matter, serve as a stimulation for your writing?
Well, yes, I certainly owe a great deal to the people who taught me. Now, Mr. Thoreau Henry, who was a very good friend of our family, used to take me out in a boat on the pond, and he could reach into the water and pull up a fish. He knew that pond so well. Henry was a great inspiration to me in many ways in my love of nature and the things he taught us about that. And without Mr. Emerson, our family many times would have gone without food. There's no question about that.
Where do you think you're going from here? What do you see happening in the next few years of your life?
Work. Work.
At
it
what?
Is and always has been my salvation. There is more demand all the time for more stories. I'm hard at work right now on a sequel to Eight Cousins, which I'm going to call Rose in Bloom. But there are eternally young people demanding my stories, and I suppose I will continue to work. When I was young, I had no money. Now that I have money, I have no time. Life's always been a puzzle to me. I wonder if I'll ever figure it out.
What's Rose in Bloom going to be about?
Well, if you remember, Eight Cousins was a story about a young woman who was taken into the home of her uncle, who taught her how to live a much better life than she had lived before, to get along without tight corsets and silly, stylish fripperies, and to enjoy being out of doors and learning about foreign countries. Well, now we have to follow Rose, and I'm afraid, I suppose, we are going to have to marry Rose off to someone. That's what my readers expect. You know, in Little Women, I did not want to marry Jo to anyone. I wanted her to be like me, an independent spinster. But I kept getting letters from all of the young people who read the book saying, who is Jo going to marry? They wanted Jo to marry Laurie, and I wouldn't stand for that. So I made up a new mate for her. And that pleased me a little bit, though some of the readers were very disappointed.
Well, romance wins out, obviously.
Yes, but... yes.
Well, good luck to you, Miss Ellicott, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much. It's very pleasant to talk to you.
Right. You've been listening to American writer Louisa May Alcott, and we'll be back in a moment. You just heard Anne Howard's impersonation of Louisa May Alcott. Anne Howard is Professor Emerita at the University of Nevada, Reno, where she taught American literature and woman writers. She's affiliated with the Great Plains and National Chautauquas, for whom she's performed all over the country as Louisa May Alcott, Kate Chopin, and Dorothy Parker. Welcome, Anne.
Welcome to you, Todd.
And this time as Anne Howard. Your thoughts on Louisa May Alcott?
Well, I think she was a wonderful inspiration for people because although she talked a lot about the standard values, behind it all was her recognition that a woman needed to be strong, independent, and to think for herself. She may have had some problems with getting this across to people, but it's a kind of subversive message in everything she wrote.
Is that why you chose her?
Well, that's why I found her interesting. I read all of Louisa May Alcott when I was a child, before I was 10, and I still remember reading the last book that I of hers that was available, which was An Old-Fashioned Girl. This was before all the thrillers came out. There was an illustration of a young girl riding into Boston on a cart with her little bird in a cage and a kitten in her lap. I'm not sure it was precise to the book, but it looked to me like the most exciting thing in the world, to be going off on your own to a new city. And she certainly affected my life that way, and I think a lot of other women reacted that way.
Now, you're driving this message pretty hard. What has been the public's response to your characterization of Alcott?
Well, everybody's interested in her, and everyone thinks a lot of her. Some of the younger women say, how could she stand there and take care of her family and never do anything much for herself? Well, I felt that that was always interesting to talk about, that one did not necessarily lose interest in taking care of one's family if one still tried to stand up for oneself. And of course, her heroines of her thrillers were women who didn't necessarily do what was expected of them anyway.
why not just lecture and or speak or write about her? Why impersonate her?
Well, I think it makes quite a difference to the people if they can put themselves imaginatively into the time of the writer. I think that's rather different from hearing about the writer. Sometimes they've read the writer's work. Certainly in Alcott's case, there are so many people that have read those books, men and women alike. I can't tell you how many men told me, well, I read that book three times, once for each of my daughters, or things to that effect, where they had read out loud. But I think it gives a different slant, because we're able to talk about how that author's mind worked. We always try to work with first-person things, and for people like Alcott, who wrote thousands of letters and kept a journal ever from the time she was about 9 until her death year, we are given a good deal of wonderful material they wouldn't normally meet.
Will you be on the road this summer, and if so, where and where can we find you?
Well, this summer I'm doing Louisa again in Greenville, South Carolina, and Asheville, North Carolina. Okay. And then I'm performing locally in Reno as Dorothy Parker, my current new one.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to that. Well, thank you for joining us today, Ann.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Ann Howard, Professor of American Literature and National Chautauquan. For our site of the week, we have chosen the town we just visited in our interview with Louisa May Alcott. Here to tell you all about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Concord, Massachusetts has played a remarkable role in the history of New England and the nation. It is known as the site of the first organized resistance to British rule. In fact, the North Bridge in Concord was where the famous shot heard around the world took place. The homes of many well-known writers, including Louisa May Alcott, Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Henry David Thoreau, are on display, and you will also find Walden Pond and Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. The list goes on of historical sites. However, before you see Concord, be sure to visit the Concord Museum, where Concord's history begins.
We celebrate Mother's Day this week. We know what it means to us, but how do historians see the holiday? Here to give us her perspective is Ruth Rosen, professor of history at the University of California at Davis and the author of The Woman's Movement and Unfinished Revolution, published by Viking Press.
Every year, people snipe at the shallow commercialism of Mother's Day. But, you know, to ignore your mother on this holy holiday is unthinkable. And if you are a mother, you'll be devastated if your ingrates fail to honor you at least one day a year. But Mother's Day wasn't always like this. The women who conceived Mother's Day would actually be bewildered by the ubiquitous ads that hound us to find that perfect gift for mom. And they would expect women to be marching in the streets, not eating with their families in restaurants. This is because Mother's Day began as a holiday that commemorated women's public activism, not as a celebration of a mother's devotion to her family. The story begins in 1858, when a community activist named Anna Reeves Jarvis organized Mother's Work Days in West Virginia. What her immediate goal was to improve the sanitation in Appalachian communities. In 1872, Julia Ward Howe, who was the author of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, proposed an annual Mother's Day for peace. She was committed to abolishing all war. And so for the next 30 years, Americans celebrated Mother's Day for Peace on June 2nd. Now, a lot of these middle-class women in the 19th century believed that they bore a special responsibility as actual or potential mothers, and that what they were supposed to do was to care for the casualties of society and to turn America into a more civilized nation. To them, the connection between motherhood and the fight for social and economic justice seems so obvious, so self-evident. In 1913, Congress declared the second Sunday in May to be Mother's Day. By then, the growing consumer culture had successfully redefined women as consumers for their families. As the Florist Review, the industry's trade journal, bluntly put it, this was a holiday that could be exploited. The new advertising industry quickly taught Americans how to honor their mothers by spending a lot of money, and especially by buying flowers. Since then, Mother's Day, as everyone knows, has ballooned into a million-dollar industry. Now, Americans may revere the idea of motherhood and love their own mothers, but not all mothers. Poor, unemployed mothers may enjoy flowers, but they also need child care, job training, health care, a higher minimum wage, and paid parental leave. And working mothers may enjoy breakfast in bed, but they also need the kind of governmental assistance provided by every other industrialized society. With just a little imagination, we could restore Mother's Day as a holiday that celebrates women's political engagement in society. During the 1980s, some peace groups gathered at nuclear test sites on Mother's Day to protest the arms race. Today, our greatest threat is from our indifference toward human welfare and the health of our planet. Imagine an annual Million Mothers March in the nation's capital. Imagine a Mother's Day filled with voices demanding social and economic justice and a sustainable future, rather than speeches studded with syrupy platitudes. Now, some will think it insulting to alter our current way of celebrating Mother's Day, but public activism does not preclude private expressions of love and gratitude, and nor, by the way, does it prevent people from expressing their appreciation all year round. 19th century women dared to dream of a day that honored women's civic activism. We can do no less. We should honor their vision with civic activism.
You've been listening to Ruth Rosen, author of The Woman's Movement, An Unfinished Revolution. And this is Talking History. Finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, we have one major program to call to your attention this week. 50 years ago, American and United Nations troops fought a bitter and bloody war in a country unfamiliar to most Americans. The Korean conflict is often called the Forgotten War, but it has never been forgotten by the men and women who experienced it. In Korean War Stories, which airs on PBS on May 27th, veterans share their extraordinary experiences and memories. Be sure to check your local listings for the exact showtime. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
I'm no woman, I've got experience. I'm no woman, I've got experience. And there ain't no way I'd ever be a young woman again.